Support for this episode of I Hear a Sherlock Everywhere is made possible by the Wessex Press, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com. And the Baker Street Journal, the leading publication of Sherlockian scholarship since 1946. Subscriptions available at bakerstreetjournal.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, Episode 80, The Great Detective, an interview with Zach Dundas.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became astronomer.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Baker Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Walder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Well, well, well. Hello there, and welcome back once again to another episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees, where it's always 1895. I'm one of your hosts, Scott Monty.
I'm also one of your many hosts, Burt Wilder.
How many more are we getting?
Well, there are the Ritz brothers, the Three Stooges, Abbott and Costello.
All fine folks to have around.
Manny, Moe and Jack, the Pep Boys.
The Marx Brothers, Everly Brothers, right. Corsican Brothers,
right.
Dr. Joyce Brother. There was actually a great track off of the Addams Family soundtrack, the original Addams Family movie with Raul Julia. Remember him?
Oh, sure.
Singing.
He's a great actor.
He was great, yeah, but he sang a song all about brothers. Thanks to his own brother,
that's
Uncle
right.
Fester.
Fester.
The German brothers Grimm. There's Orville Wright
and Wilbur.
Orville's nothing minus him. There's Smith brothers and the Marx brothers and the Ritz and the Brooks and the Everly brothers, Solomon brothers, Nicholas brothers, Corsican brothers, and Dr. Joyce brothers. Brothers, big, big brothers. Watch them break the pack. The Warner brothers, Harry, Sammy, Irvin, and Jack. I know there's a host of others. I've had to neglect some brothers. Just too many names to cram. But frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
There was one meeting of Cox and Company of New England up in New Hampshire where I quoted some of the lyrics there as one of my toasts to Mycroft Holmes.
Huh.
So, Sherlockian brothers.
I like that.
Yeah. So what's new in your world?
What's new? Well, it's I'm at a loss for an answer. It's a blizzard. The whole summer has been sort of just a whirlwind.
I know. It's a good time to get caught
up. But we've had an opportunity to see each other more than usual. I mean, we've seen each other actually physically twice.
That
this
is
summer
true.
Because you were just here for the Ash dinner last Wednesday.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I happened to be in New York on the first Wednesday of August, and it just hit me as I was making my arrangements to come into town the Monday before that, oh my goodness, the first Wednesday of every month is the traditional meeting of the monthly meeting of the Adventuresses of Sherlock Holmes, as they call their events, Ash Wednesdays. Highly appropriate. Right. And lo and behold, there you were.
Yeah.
There you were. And we had an interesting tweet from our friend Matt Laffey from Always 1895, who was there as well. He said, last night's Ash Wednesday featuring the usual NYC crew plus Scott Monty and Burt Walder, it was like an episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere in full surround sound.
Yeah, it was a good group. Well, on Evie and John, Besh were there. From Maryland, and Greg Ruby had come up.
Yeah.
Also from Maryland. Oh, yeah. And Stephen Rothman was there, and Janice.
That's true, from Philly, yeah. Rare, yeah, it's a wonderful
rare
tradition.
Personal appearance.
Indeed. Well, if you find yourself in New York the first Wednesday of every month, go to Eamon's Pub or Eamon's Grill on, was it West 45th Street? So
but
wonderful.
But we have to tell Susan first, so there's a.
Well, that's true. That's true.
Let us know. Let us know.
Let us know, sure. And we'll get in touch with Susan and let her know. Yeah. But it's a great way to spend a Wednesday evening in New York if you happen to be in town. Yeah. And if not, you know, I'll bet your own Sherlockian group has its own traditions. You know, what is it that you do on a regular basis to make it fun for your members outside of the more traditionalist and posh dinners? Let us know.
Yeah. And this is a great group because there are no toasts. There are no papers. It's just conversation.
It's an excuse to get together and eat and drink.
Yeah.
What? Sherlockians do that?
Yeah. And friends, that's an important part of the new Sherlock Holmes brand diet, because the best way to lose weight is to simply sign up for only eating and drinking when you're with other Sherlockians. Well, watch the pounds melt away.
Depending on where you live.
Right.
If you're like our interview guest, who you'll hear from later on in this episode, it may be quite easy to get on that diet with no Sherlockians around.
That's true.
But so yeah, let us know. Give us a shout. There are lots of ways to reach us, such as by email at comment@ihearofsherlock.com. You could call us on our listener comment line, 774-221-READ.
Mm-hmm.
That's 774-221-7323.
Yes, and we've just refitted all of the payphones in your area so that they now take British shillings from the 19th century. So just slide one of those in there and off you go.
That's it. They pay out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one of the funniest things I saw in my formative years on a first visit to Vegas is when a friend, before we went into the casino, he went up to an ATM to get some cash so he could play inside. And he put his card in, he made his selection, and then the 20s started coming out. And he said, "Oh, my God, it's paying out." it's a good line. Feel free to get in touch with us however it makes sense for you. You could even do an MP3 recording on your phone and attach it to an email and send it in if you want to do an audio comment that way.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, we're also on the Facebook, the Twitter, the Tumblr.
Mm-hmm.
We're on Instagram from time to time, but not as much as we used to be.
Mm-hmm.
But just look for I Hear of Sherlock in any of those, mm-hmm. and you will find I Hear of Sherlock literally everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Now, we love art, friends, so here's a thing to do. Get an ordinary 16x20 stretched canvas, write a message on it in carefully hand-drawn Gothic calligraphy, cover it up with a couple of layers of white house paint found for only $1 a can at Home Depot, and then once that cures, just sand it down with the power sander of your choice until elements of your message are peeking through, and before you frame it in your rec room or living room, take off the wooden support straps, roll it up, and mail it to Canton, Michigan, so we can hear from you.
And if you're lucky, we will auction it off to Jerry Margolin to hang in his collection in Portland, Oregon.
That's right. It's an original Jackson Pollock.
Oh, that's great. So, well, thank you for being with us once again. Just a reminder, we've got content that we share on a regular basis, not only on Facebook, but on our Flipboard magazine at ihose.co/flipsherlock and on our Scoop It site at ihose.co/scoopsherlock. Those are all lowercase URLs there, so check it out. And, of course, if you do subscribe to us on iTunes, please consider leaving us a review. We've seen a few come in lately, and we do appreciate that. You can find our link on iTunes up at bit.ly/IHearOfSherlock. Well, speaking of news and things we've flipped and things we've pinned and shared and all that, what do we have in the way of the news?
Oh, well, there's always a tremendous amount of news. Some of the news is we've gotten some wonderful donations from people.
That's true.
Which we must thank Hine and Company, James O'Leary, and Michael O'Connor, who have used the PayPal donate button to contribute to our efforts. That's always it's always big news over here, friends.
Yes, it is.
And the other news, of course, is Mr. Holmes has been out. We had a lovely review, thanks to you, on ihose.co. You can read that at ihose.co/Mr. Holmes 2.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because, and we were talking about this a little bit at the Ash Wednesday dinner. Mr. Holmes is a very, very different Sherlock Holmes film. I was actually listening to Sir Ian McKellen on another podcast. Unfortunately, our invitation must have gotten lost in the mail. But he was on WTF with Mark Maron and talking about, how the bulk of the film is really about the aging process and things that we all face as humans someday, the failing of the body, the failing of the mind, and how ironic it was that Sherlock Holmes in this film was in fact losing his memory, losing his mind, and how that impacted him as a real human, Sherlock Holmes the man, not Sherlock Holmes the literary character. And I think Ian McKellen just did a phenomenal job in his portrayal of Holmes.
Well, the whole production, I think we may have talked about this, but, it's a Bill Condon film, and Bill Condon directed McKellen in 2009 or something like that in Gods and Monsters. And Condon has, apparently, according to interviews I've heard McKellen give, this continuing fascination with interesting characters and how they got that way. And I think that's really an element of what you see in the portrayal of Holmes, Holmes at his prime, Holmes as a much older man that characterizes that film.
Yeah. Well, it's well worth a see. And I would be surprised if, even though this is a small film, if it wasn't a recipient of a few Academy Award nominations. Maybe cinematography, if we're so lucky, acting for Sir Ian.
And Laura Linney, too. Apparently, Laura Linney is a lifelong Sherlock Holmes fan.
Is she?
Yeah, because I saw... McKellen and Linney were out in California, which is, I guess, how they got to Mark Maron. And, they also popped in at Google, and you can find on YouTube this almost hour long interview that they did. Apparently they screened the film at Google headquarters and then sat for questions. And a couple of the questions were quite interesting, but along the way she mentioned that she's been, as she put it, I think, a Sherlock Holmes fanatic since she was a child.
Well, we will be sure to include a link to that YouTube video in the show notes. That's great. Other things in the news here. We had Matthias Bostrom write another piece for us. Matthias is always good for something controversial and things that involve a little bit of research. He, of course, wrote about the quote-unquote lost Sherlock Holmes story that was supposedly discovered in someone's attic in Edinburgh earlier this year. But this time, Matthias got to the bottom of the case of the Sir Arthur Conan Doyle Literary Estate Limited. Does that sound familiar to you, Bert?
No, never heard of it.
Well, the Conan Doyle Estate Limited, of course, is the business entity that's been giving a lot of authors a run for their money, literally. and of course, was part of the Free Sherlock movement that's happened over the past year and a half that we have covered quite extensively here. If you haven't heard the interview we did with Les Klinger, check that out at ihose.co/freesherlock. But in this case, Matthias took a look at Andrea Plunkett, who is the widow of Sheldon Reynolds, who owned the rights to Sherlock Holmes from the 1950s on, when the Ronald Howard series came out. Mm. She, of course, has made the unexplicable move to try and copyright not only all of the stories, but all of the characters in them as well, and has failed every time. And yet, there are some unsuspecting authors that are paying licensing fees to her and her organization. And Matthias just wanted to make sure he cleared that up for everyone. It's astounding that this kind of confusion continues to happen.
It would be great if these different estates had a coat of arms, and at the bottom of it, there was a Latin motto that you could translate that said, "We run for your money." Wouldn't that be great? I wonder what that would be in Latin.
That's great. I'll have to look that up.
Yeah.
Well, and if you're interested in adorning a vehicle.
Yes.
A laptop.
Get your sticker.
A refrigerator. Whatever you want to stick things on. Could be your cat.
Yes.
We have oval stickers for sale. You can find those at ihose.co/221bstickers. You can get a 221B oval sticker or an 1895 sticker. So the orders have been coming in pretty steadily over the course of the last week as they've been available. So check that out and feel free to make a purchase. It makes a great gift if you're interested in surprising someone of the Sherlockian ilk with your cleverness. It's certainly great for your own stuff. Maybe something you want to distribute at your science society. Let us know, and we would be happy to make those available to you.
Mm-hmm. And friends, with a little chain and thread, you can stick multiple copies of these things together back to back and make your own Sherlockian wind chimes. And we would love to see your photographs of interesting creative uses, applications of these stickers. And in the upcoming presidential campaign, the more you can find political posters into which you can affix these 221B stickers, preferably over the faces of the candidates, we would be very interested in that as well.
Oh, boy. It's always good for a debate. You know, I don't think there's a record of who had the worst hair in the canon. And I'm thinking of the recent Republican debates.
Canon. Oh, that's an interesting topic.
Yeah. There's no record of a comb-over, is there?
Well, I don't think they'd invented comb-overs in the 19th century, although Thornycroft Huxtable, I seem to remember some description about his hair.
Well, of course, hair was a major fixture in the Red-Headed League.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, but not you know, wild, bizarre.
No. Yeah, could be an interesting treatise for some.
Hmm.
Oh, of course, we know in some of the later 1940s films, Basil Rathbone had a hair issue. Looked like he stood backwards in a wind tunnel. What was that? Sherlock Holmes in Washington?
Yeah, I think so. But also poor Jeremy Brett had that one season where...
Oh, yeah. He cut his own hair and they had to make do with it best they could.
Put his head in a blender or something like that.
Well, speaking of debates.
Yes.
Sherlockian. You say Sherlockian. I say Sherlockian.
I say Holmesian.
Well, that's
you say Holmesian. I say Holmesian.
that too. But Chris Redmond wrote a nice piece for us by that title, where he looked at Sherlockians versus Sherlockians.
Hmm.
You know, we've had this hobby for some decades, and some of us have called ourselves Sherlockians. And as you just noted, some call themselves Holmesians or Holmesians.
Mm.
But now that the fandom of Sherlock has come along and appropriated the title Sherlockian, what's there to tell the two groups apart? Is there a need to tell the two groups apart? Are there more similarities than differences? Chris gets into it on Sherlockians and Sherlockians, and you can check it out with the link through our show notes.
Well, I think we should at least promote a different pronunciation. How about Sherlockians? Sherlockians and Sherlockians.
Interloke. Cutor. No, I don't know.
Or, you know, we could just spell Sherlockian backward, which would be Sneak-Ulrich. Sherlockians and Sneak-Ulrich.
Isn't that what the Russian Sherlock Holmes fans call themselves?
Oh, Sneak-Ulrich.
Sneak-Ulrich. Well, that and everything else you need to know in the Sherlock Holmes world is here on the Sherlock Holmes News.
Yes.
Well, I guess we should pay some bills.
Oh, God.
I know. It's necessary, but we love our sponsors.
Checks just keep coming back every time we try to deposit them.
They do. By the way, if you're interested in becoming a sponsor for I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, please drop us a line and let us know.
No. Just send us some money. First thing to do. We have a pre-invoice policy.
That's
just
true.
Just send us $50.
No. $500.
Five? Oh, well.
Yeah, no, we got to set the bar high here.
I'm looking at something achievable.
Now, if you're interested, seriously, in becoming a sponsor for I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, and we do have occasional one-off sponsors on some of our episodes, we do reach a niche audience, as you probably know, a very dedicated and rabid audience. Drop us a line right there on the contact section of ihearofsherlock.com. We give you an opportunity to learn about our rates, which we do not remit, but they are fixed.
And remember, friends, our motto is we scratch a niche audience.
We scratch a niche.
That's true.
So, but the sponsors that we do have with us, we are very thankful for. Of those, one includes the Wessex Press.
Yes, the Wessex Press.
WessexPress.com, of course. You can find all of their stuff. I think one of the ones that they were recently interested in getting a few more eyeballs on was the Watson Chronicles by Anne Margaret Lewis. A series of short stories there featuring the good and great doctor and some of his travails. So check out the Watson Chronicles there.
Yes.
And, of course,
it's reported to be an intimate novel of mystery, conflict, and personal revelations.
Indeed.
So if you're interested in Dr. Watson's underclothes, you will find it in Chapter 3.
Dr. Watson's undercarriage. Yes. Well, he was the driver, right?
He was the driver, that's right. My God, Watson, those are springs.
Sparking plugs.
Steady.
Yes, it goes home.
Steady.
Also, you can check out One Fixed Point in a Changing Age, a look at Sherlockians in today's internet age, written by a number of the women from the Baker Street Babes, as well as other contributors there. It's a delightful look at scholarship as we know it, as it has evolved from the sleepy days of the early Baker Street Journal through to what's happening right now. Right now, as you listen on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So check that out. And speaking of the Baker Street Journal, why they're a sponsor too, aren't they?
Oh, they are. They are. And let us call your attention to the new Science Society special, where you can save 20% at BakerStreetJournal.com. Are you planning, friends, to discuss one of the stories covered by the Baker Street Irregulars Press manuscript series at your next meeting? Or do you just want to provide the members of your local Sherlockian Science Society with an opportunity to acquire the best canonical publications at a discount? Well, now you can, by taking advantage of the Science Society special, because signs that order 10 or more copies of the same title sent to a single address will receive a 20% discount and very favorable shipping rates. And you can find out all about that and much more at BakerStreetJournal.com.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Well, and of course, we would be remiss if we didn't recognize our final sponsor.
Friends, if you're like me, you're tired of losing all those Sherlockian quizzes because you can't remember the square root of Morse Hudson's address or the color of Vincent Spaulding's collar buttons. That's why you need new Sherlock Holmes brand genetic memory. All the words of the canon have now been encoded in new genes, easily delivered into your cells by bacteria specially engineered by BSI scientists. It's the only genetic memory aid that delivers the three C's. Consistent, contest, conquest, conquest. Don't be fooled by other treatments that require expensive electrodes implanted in your hippocampus. Get instant recall of every fact by choosing Sherlock Holmes brand genetic memory today. Sherlock Holmes brand genetic memory is not to be used with other implants such as breast or dental. Tell your doctor if you frequently drink water or eat food. Sherlock Holmes brand genetic memory may increase your risk of sitting quietly at home smiling to yourself in the dark. Not available in California.
That's great. Oh, I think Nick Martorelli was actually part of the experimental prototype of that, wasn't he?
I think so.
Wow. Wow, I could have used that many years ago at some of those speckled band quiz meetings.
That's right.
Oh, that's great. On episode 80 here, we are pleased to have a guest with us again. It's always fun when we can invite someone in for an interview. And in this case, we were fortunate enough to secure Zach Dundas. Zach, of course, is the author of a new book called The Great Detective, The Amazing Rise and Immortal Life of Sherlock Holmes, of course, available from Amazon and all your local book dealers. Zach, of course, is also co-executive editor of Portland Monthly, and he's a longtime journalist, and you'll see a little bit about that coming through in the book, and we'll discuss that with him shortly. And Zach has written another book previously called The Renegade Sportsman. He is a member of the Sherlock Holmes Society of London and the Diogenes Club, and the founder of a very early Sherlock Holmes club for children. Zach, welcome to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere.
Yes.
So nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
So where are you today?
I'm in Missoula, Montana, or just outside Missoula, Montana. Homeland to me, and I'm looking out over some forested hillsides and waiting for some deer to trot by, and otherwise feeling fairly far removed psychogeographically from the Sherlockian world.
That's pretty nice.
Was Conan Doyle ever in Montana, I wonder?
No, you know, he went to Banff, which is just north of the border in Canada, during one of his western wanderings, but did not cross the border.
Now, no offense to people in Banff, but why the heck would you want to go there when you've got big sky country right to your south?
Well, you know, I think he preferred to keep most of his travel within the Commonwealth or the Empire, as it would have been.
Or the former Empire in some cases.
Right. Well, but he had, a network of folks there, including folks who would line up to pay money to hear him lecture. So I didn't think there were many elk in Montana that were interested in spiritualism.
So, Montana, I know that's not your current state of residence, but it does bring to mind where you got your start. And I think our listeners would be really interested to know, how did you first meet Sherlock Holmes?
Well, I think like many people, it was a sort of byproduct of a precocious childhood reading program. And as I recount in my book, there was a particular moment when I checked a sort of boys Sherlock Holmes anthology from the 1950s out of my 1980s school library. And that was the first moment when I was really riveted by Holmes and Conan Doyle's writing, of which I had of course been aware, earlier, but that was sort of the moment of discovery. It was an anthology that in my memory included about a half a dozen of the short stories and two of the novels, Sign of the Four and The Hound of the Baskervilles. To my certain knowledge, The Sign of the Four was heavily edited to remove the drug use, as I later discovered. and there was a number of different sort of expurgations in the text, as I recall. But the sort of the romance and glamour and Victorian period atmosphere was so far removed, of course, from my lovely but very sort of Western and 1980s childhood that I think that was a primary factor in my growing obsession from that point on.
Do you remember how old you were?
I was about 11 or 12. I don't remember precisely, but as nearly as I can reconstruct, it would have been the winter when I was 11 years old.
And do you remember what you read? Which stories you read? Or?
A Scandal in Bohemia was in the book. The Speckled Band was in the book. And beyond that, I don't remember the precise lineup of the short stories. It led pretty quickly to the discovery on my parents' bookshelf of an old copy of the complete Sherlock Holmes, the Doubleday Complete. So I think I pretty quickly abandoned the expurgated anthology for the real thing.
Good call.
Every once in a while I make a good decision.
Now, you mentioned in the book that this was a time, if people can even imagine it, when the world did not have the internet.
Right.
And research was a little more intensive and a little more involved back then. But how did you go from discovering this 1950s book in your 1980s library to your parents' complete edition to actually discovering that there were other people like you out there who had this strange interest and this common interest in a wonderful hero from literature's pages?
I don't remember when I exactly first took up the tangled skein, Scott, but I think that it may well have been some glancing mention in the Christopher Morley introduction to that Doubleday anthology, which many people know, that first put me on the trail, or maybe looking into Morley himself. I mean, once I really got into Sherlock Holmes, I, of course, raided the shelves of the local public library for all the related volumes. And, there's even at the time, there's quite a collection of Sherlockiana, even in a small town public library. And very early on, The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes came my way, and other books, the William S. Baring-Gould books, the annotated Sherlock Holmes and his biography of Sherlock Holmes were both available in the library. And I think through some combination of reading those and reading sort of around those, the material that I could find, in magazines and so forth, I became aware of the Sherlockian subculture and the Sherlockian world.
And did you read Morley? Did you want to find out more about Morley and read his essays?
Only as an adult, really. I think that when you're 12, you tend to be a micro-focused obsessive, I think, or there's a certain disposition that tends that way.
Well, there's some of us that still do that at 40 too.
Right,
so,
sure.
In my
memory, I certainly was aware that he had this big body of work, but I considered it sort of odd that he would have ever thought about anything else besides Sherlock Holmes. So I didn't actually work back through any of his other material until I was an adult. Mm. And to be honest, I mean, his body of work is so huge, I've really only read a fraction of it. But he's one of these impressive characters that you find once you start delving into the history of Sherlock Holmes, who was really sort of a phenomenon in his own right.
Yeah. And what about, did you become a collector? Are you a collector type or are you a reader type?
When I talk to Jerry Margolin, who's in the book and who is one of the leading collectors of Sherlockian material, he sort of pointed out something that had never really occurred to me, which is that you're sort of born a collector or you're not. Mm. And I'm far too disorganized to collect anything. I certainly have a lot of stuff, but I wouldn't call it a collection of any kind.
Well, it sounds like you're more of an accumulator.
Yeah. I mean, you know, for example, I have the sort of bound volumes of the original series of the Baker Street Journal. I have a box full of Sherlock Holmes journals sort of randomly going back into the 70s, but they're not, they weren't really acquired with any kind of grand strategy.
So, you want to tell us about how you started reaching out to other Sherlockians and you know, expanding the world beyond Missoula, Montana?
Yeah, you know, this is one thing that was really fun for me to remember and think about and write about a little bit in the book, which is that, you know, not very long ago, this was that sort of outreach was a process of, you know, sort of finding addresses in the backs of what Sherlockian or Sherlockian-ish magazines that could come to hand, you know, tracking down an address for the Baker Street Journal and getting a subscription and going through the reports of the science societies and writing to people who seemed interesting on actual, you know, paper with actual stamps. And of course, as you both well know, the Sherlockian world tends to be very, very welcoming. And I think particularly at that time, 13-year-old, and, you know, I had a sort of wonderful responses from all over the place, all over the place, meaning pretty much anywhere outside the boundaries of Montana. I couldn't find any Sherlockians close to home. So I started my own society, which consisted of me, you know, writing to the Baker Street Journal and saying that I had one, which is a time-honored method, as I would later learn. It was called the Street Arabs, and it was posited as the Global Society for Young Sherlockians because I didn't lack for hubris, I guess. And amazingly enough, a lot of people responded from all over the world. And for several years, I had a real going concern on my hands. It turned out to be a little bit more than my adolescent organizational capacities were up for, and sort of died a, you know, sad and slow death under my watch. But I think that the initial response and the way that the Sherlockian world even then functioned as a sort of analog social network really says a lot about you know, not only how culture in general functioned in the pre-internet era, but about the Sherlockian world in and of itself and how it has always functioned from, you know, from those early days.
Absolutely. And I seem to recall that there was a young Swedish gentleman.
Yes, there was a young Swede who's gone on to infamy.
And who might that be?
Mattias Boström, which is one of the most delightful aspects of working on this book, The Great Detective, which kind of took me back into the Sherlockian world after many years away really, was reconnecting with him and a couple of the other old street Arabs as well, and finding that, you know, for whatever organizational mismanagement I may have committed, I at least had a couple of reputable people around in the group, or disreputable as the case may be. Certainly, Mr. Boström, has gone on to sort of great renown within the Sherlockian world and has amazing waistcoats. I don't know if you've seen them.
Oh, sure.
A set of sort of, period appropriate whiskers that I could never match myself. So, you know, I'm quite proud of the street Arab alums who are still sort of orbiting the Sherlockian world.
Yeah, that's you know, an auspicious beginning. And, you know, Mattias, of course, had written a book called Från Holmes till Sherlock, which was a Swedish-only book, has been published and translated in other languages. And I understand it is in the process of being translated into English for publication fairly
soon. I know,
shortly.
A prospect which makes me, you know, somewhat nervous because it's my impression that it is essentially the same story that I've written in a much different way and probably with a lot greater scholarly acumen than mine. So, you know, I think that for serious Sherlockians, his volume is probably going to be the one, the volume of choice of the two. It was really funny to discover that we were essentially working on very similar projects at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, languages. Great minds, great beginnings. I mean,
I guess so.
So let's talk about that, because your book takes a very unconventional approach to, you know, it's like a mini Conan Doyle biography, because you mm-hmm. take us through portions of his life so we understand what he's up against while critical decisions are being made. And then you take us chronologically through the publication of the Holmes stories, mm-hmm. but you also intersperse it as kind of a travelogue, with your family's trips over to England. How did you come about, realizing that type of approach to this very comprehensive, subject?
Well, you know, once I determined that I wanted to write about Sherlock Holmes and what Sherlock Holmes really has become in modern culture and the way that that happened, I realized that I couldn't match, you know, the scholarly firepower of people who make a serious study of the subject. I'm not a trained scholar, and I don't really have that sort of intellectual disposition, if you want to put it that way. I'm a journalist by training, and really what I do as a writer is I write about things I've seen and places I've been and people I've talked to. That's essentially what I do for a living. And so I decided to apply that method to the Sherlockian world. And I realized early on that it was, you know, at least however well I may or may not have pulled it off, it was at least a viable approach, because although Sherlock Holmes is allegedly a fictional character, I keep hearing that heresy bandied about, his world has sort of interestingly merged with our world to an extent that, you know, there are endless numbers of people one could talk to. There are endless numbers of places one could go and things to look at. So the sort of journalistic raw material was plentiful. Mm-hmm. And so I knew that there was lots of stuff in the modern, you know, allegedly real world for me to go check out and write about. And then the question became, so how do I handle the vast amount of material that exists already? And I decided that for as many different ways as one could approach the topic, I would stick fairly closely as an organizing principle to the publication cycle of the canon, that I would allow the sort of chronological development of the character by Conan Doyle to be the main structural element of the book, and that would, you know, take me about two thirds of the way home. And then once the 60 stories had been published, I would then, figure out how to deal with all that came afterwards. But that thematically, some of the stuff that is worth talking about, such as the evolution of Sherlockian societies and, the advent of what we now call, or some now call, transmedia Holmes, would naturally sort of evolve out of the publication of the 60 stories. There would be moments in that chronological structure where I could sort of branch off and talk about things as they sort of logically occurred. And then I would also, you know, weave my own humble and discombobulated adventures around the world in as was sort of logical according to the chronology of the publication of the stories for the most part. So it was really a, you know, it was either a technique or a crutch, or a strategy for dealing with this sort of incomprehensibly vast subject. You know, once you start really taking into account all that has been written, said, and done regarding Sherlock Holmes, it's far too much material for any mortal mind to comprehend. So I had to pick a few strategies that would get me through the thing.
Yeah.
And that was that. Those are a few of them.
So who's ultimately, because there's a lot of material here that seems familiar to those who may have some passing knowledge of the character, but it also seems like it's introductory in nature and in another way. Who's your intended audience with this?
It's definitely written for a general audience who's interested in popular culture and literature. I had in mind a book that would really examine how Sherlock Holmes evolved into this, I don't even really know what to call it even now, this phenomenon that is compelling enough in 2015 that you have multiple series of major entertainment productions going on at the same time, and an apparently inexhaustible interest in, at various levels, published material about the character, and you have this sort of small but real Sherlockian tourism industry that exists in England. I wanted to write a book for a reader who might or might not be familiar with all the ins and outs of the canon, but who is interested in how culture evolves, how ideas sort of multiply and, as we say now, go viral, and would be interested in watching that occur over the course of, you know, the 130 years that the narrative takes place in. It's really sort of an attempt to use Sherlock Holmes as a sort of laboratory demonstration of how our culture works in some ways. I mean, this sort of phenomenon of a character becoming almost mythological and being relaunched again and again, and there being millions of different sort of versions and takes on a character, is almost, you know, sort of core to the way that entertainment works now and the way that people think of cultural characters. You know, how many times has Batman or James Bond been rebooted or relaunched or given a different spin? And you can really look at Sherlock Holmes as the first and greatest example of that in many ways, and the one certainly that has had the longest run, with the richest material to look at. So that's really where I was coming from. I certainly hope that people who are well versed in the character will find something to enjoy in the book. I'm not under any illusions that they'll find anything new that they don't know. So it was an interesting challenge in some ways to write something that I thought would appeal to confirmed devotees, and also something that would be accessible to a general audience.
Sure. Well, it's a great fit for readers and listeners of our site and show, because we bill ourselves as the intersection of Sherlock Holmes and popular culture. So it's great to see that being expressed through your work.
Well, thank you. And there's so much, you know, that the years that I was working on the book, there was so much going on. You know, it was really sort of through no great insight or design of mine, it was a great time to be working on the book, because I really was working on it coincidental to the real emergence of the Cumberbatch phenomenon and all of the sort of associated fan culture and internet chatter and debate and all of the things that have come out of the incredible, you know, phenomenal popularity of that series, which wasn't even, you know, when I started working on the book, it had begun to percolate, but I was really sort of watching it in awe as it became what it has become.
Yeah.
Likewise, you know, Elementary wasn't really on the scene when I started working, and it's sort of somewhat checkered career has been interesting to watch, although I didn't write about it a lot. But it sort of testifies to the fact that Sherlock Holmes is in the air right now.
Yeah. Well, and that's interesting. Like, we've got, what, 2-3 seasons of Elementary underway now, at, what, 26 episodes per season. That's a lot of episodes.
It's a lot of episodes.
And
could make the argument that you could watch a few and be good. But on the other hand, I do have some affection for what they've done there.
Yeah.
Johnny Lee Miller's portrayal of Holmes, although I know that this is not a universally held opinion. I think his portrayal of Holmes is quite interesting, and certainly distinctive and something that no other actor has done with the role.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like these things happen to the character that no one could have imagined. And then they become sort of folded into the larger corpus of Sherlockiana sort of seamlessly, which I think is testament to the sort of power of the original idea that Conan Doyle created,
yeah,
but also to the sort of interesting collaborative nature of what Sherlock Holmes has become, where, you know, thousands of people over 130 years have contributed this and that to what has become this incredible mythos.
As you got into this, what surprised you? What did you learn? What did you learn about the process of bringing a book to market? What did you learn about Holmes? What did you learn about popular culture? What surprises?
I was reminded on a personal level that if you're going to write a book about anything, you better love it, because you're going to be sitting there with it for years. several people have asked me if I'm going to write another book, and I have sort of, with a little bit of post-traumatic stress disorder, looked at them and said, when I can find something that I like as well as Sherlock Holmes to write about, I'll think about it, because it's really, you know, as I'm sure anyone can imagine, quite a process. But on a sort of larger note, what I was just talking about, the sort of incredibly collaborative nature of what Sherlock Holmes is now was not new to me, but it was something that really struck me as I continued to work on the book, and all of the sort of interesting characters that have come into the saga of Sherlock Holmes, from Basil Rathbone to Edith Meiser, the great radio scriptwriter, who was responsible for a lot of Holmes's popularity in sort of the mid-century period, to William Gillette, to all these other people who, along with Conan Doyle, who is this incredible character in his own right, have participated in some way in making Holmes what he is today. The sort of scope of that really hit home as I was working on the book.
When, what sense did you develop about Conan Doyle? Somebody asked you to describe Conan Doyle in a couple of sentences. How, I'm interested in this because, having read so many biographies of Conan Doyle, I'm always struck by how one biographer, for example, Hesketh Pearson, can look at Conan Doyle and say, well, he was every man. He was a simple soul. And other biographers come to very different conclusions. So I'm just always interested in that.
Well, question. I would say with some degree of confidence that I think Hesketh Pearson was wrong. I don't think that Conan Doyle was simple in any sense. I mean, he is this kind of Protean figure who did so many different things in his life and was this constant sort of ball of energy, just forever doing this and that and moving here and there. And when you start to really track his life through the various biographies and his, you know, the edited collection of his letters was by far the most valuable thing for me, because it was a real chronological tool, and it also provided, you know, sort of an unexpurgated look at his inner life. He just was nonstop. I mean, he wouldn't rest. He would drive himself in this most incredible way to accomplish all that he did. I think that I came out of this project with a great deal of affection for him, but also a little bit of awe and a little bit of an irritation almost, in that he just could never quite settle down. There are times when you kind of want to reach back through the ages and grab him by the lapels and just say, calm down, man. You know, you don't have to go to every city in Britain to deliver the spiritualist credo. You don't. You really just don't. But he was who he was, and was driven by a lot of different things in his life that you could get very psychoanalytical about. But in the end, you just have to sort of stand back and recognize that he was a phenomenon in his own right. He didn't really live to be that old by modern standards. And yet in his time, he crowded in about 3 or 4 lifetimes worth of action. And there's something somewhat disconcerting about that. But in the end, you just have to, I think, admire him for the sort of high degree of quality and inspiration that he brought to most of his work throughout his life.
I think
incredible energy that he expended to do it all.
It was quite a feat. And I think one of the things that you bring out in two separate areas of the book was this almost dual nature and a comparison and contrast with his father, Charles Altamont Doyle. I want to read a couple of excerpts and, you know, then get your take on it. On the one hand, on page 104, we've got a section where Conan Doyle's mother is writing about the degree to which her husband would go to satiate his need for alcohol. She said, using the most awful expedients, many times putting himself within reach of the law to get drink, every article of value he or I possessed carried off secretly. There's a public house in Edinburgh, and I'm told they have a most valuable collection of his sketches given for drink. He would strip himself of all of his underclothing, take the very bed linen, climb down the waterspout at risk of his life, break open the children's money boxes. He even drank varnish of furniture. Free again, I believe he would kill himself in a few weeks. At roughly the time Mary Doyle wrote those lines, her son would have been at work on the cardboard box. He was the cheerful clubman, the literary star, the suburban cyclist, but also a person who wondered if the cosmos had any purpose. The Anglican faith of his mother and wife was, perhaps, not hot-blooded enough for him. For years he'd been reading books about spiritualism, the pseudo-scientific pursuit of the evidence for life beyond death. He had convened seances and sought out wizened mediums. He saw things in those sessions that fed his curiosity and his very particular and peculiar sense of morality. And then later on page 207... you go back to Charles Altamont Doyle, and here we have a description of his final days that sound an awful lot like Conan Doyle in his pursuit of spiritualism. A gifted artist ends his days locked up, jabbering at his attendants, calling them devils, claiming he receives messages from an unseen world. What do you make of father and son, this complete dichotomy of individuals, one who was driven to insanity by drink, the other who was driven to relentless pursuits. And oftentimes, interestingly, in families that have chemical dependencies, you will see substitutions for particular substances, and that could be activities, it could be a monomania of sorts, it could be a dedication to certain pursuits. What do you make of this connection between Charles and Arthur?
I really started to think, and I went into the project determined not to psychoanalyze Conan Doyle, and of course you end up doing it anyway. I ended up thinking that Charles Altamont is this incredibly important figure that kind of lurks in the background of the Sherlock Holmes stories in so many different ways. I mean, I think Conan Doyle infused Holmes himself with certain aspects of his father. He certainly used some of what his father did as an artist, I think, in his own writing, the sort of incredible ability to capture color in words that Conan Doyle has reflects, I think, a lot of what his father did as an artist. Conan Doyle constantly uses these interesting sort of animal metaphors, or, he'll compare Holmes to a bird of prey. He'll use this imagery that recalls the strange and sort of visionary art that his father did, which, if anyone has seen it, is quite odd, and was the least commercial variant of the Doyle family artistic tradition by far. And I think that Conan Doyle was sort of haunted by the idea of an incredibly talented person gone wrong. If you look at many of his most vivid villains in the Sherlockian canon, they are often educated men who have gone bad. Professor Moriarty being the most prominent example, but you could also say Colonel Moran, who was, of course, a great sharpshooter and author of manly hunting memoirs before he turned to crime. Again and again, you see these sort of men of distinction and achievement who have at some point succumbed to a hereditary sort of bloodborne instinct to do bad things. And you know, it's not a great leap, I don't think, to see Charles Altamont's alcoholism sort of metaphorically explored through those characters in a way. I also think that in his life, obviously, Conan Doyle was driven by a few different demons from his past. I mean, money was a big one. When you read about the, as you just did, incredibly reduced circumstances of his upbringing, they sort of hovered on the edge of real poverty throughout his entire childhood because of his father's alcoholism. His great drive as a writer and a sort of professional person, and his real affinity for making money, I think, not in a crass way, but he just was really focused on it. If you read his letters, he writes about money a lot. I think that harks directly back to his upbringing. And I also think that his, sort of determination to succeed as an artist in a different medium, but to a much greater degree than his father ever could have. Also, I think you can point to that and say, well, that is son reacting against the sort of legacy of his father.
Well, I think that's very insightful, and you're probably onto something there.
Well, that's something, Scott. You know, one tries.
Indeed. Yeah, another. Another point you made with regard to, well, actually, it was made by an interview that you had. Another point you made with an interview that you had with Michael Saylor at the University of California, Davis, I thought was pretty interesting. It was about how Conan Doyle's creation leapt off the page and has remained part of the public's consciousness, primarily through the BSI, and what made the BSI and its early iterations different from anything that had come before, or since, I might argue.
Mm-hmm.
We've got an explanation here from Saylor, and I'll read from page 127. There had been brief eruptions of interest in particular characters before, certainly, he told me. But they were not sustained, let alone so strong decades after the characters' creations. And I'm not aware of anyone having dinners in their honor. And it's not just that the irregulars were the first or among the first. It's how influential the early BSI members were. Morley's friends tended to be journalists or other people with extraordinary access to the media. And he and others were able to shape the way fandom was perceived. They were respectable people, very eminent in some cases. And while science fiction fans tended to be seen as grubby teenagers and working-class hobbyists, anytime newspapers wrote about the Baker Street Irregulars, they made the point that, hey, these guys are not stupid. It legitimized the whole practice of fandom, and they could fight the likes of Edmund Wilson on his own terms. And Edmund Wilson, of course, was a literary critic that had earlier denounced the BSI and the cult of Sherlock Holmes as "quote unquote" infantile.
Mm-hmm. Wilson was sort of against crime fiction, full stop.
Yeah.
What was interesting about my conversation with Saylor what you just read touches on it is he talked a lot about in our interview and his book about the sort of dual evolution of science fiction fandom and the Baker Street Irregulars. It happened at roughly the same time. I mean, almost eerily synchronized, the establishment of the first, what one would identify as the first science fiction fan clubs, and the emergence of that sort of stream of fan culture and the creation of the BSI and the beginnings of the Sherlockian tradition. And there was some overlap, but really they had very different characters. And as you said, the BSI from the beginning had, I wouldn't call it an elite character, but certainly a refined character to it. The people who were attracted to it were writers and other people who had sort of creative reputations in mainstream culture. And I think that that has both informed what the BSI is and has become, and of course what it was perceived to be at the time. And it was always sort of received very respectful coverage, as opposed to, you know, what one might see even now, you know, sort of this sort of anthropological freak show coverage that things like Comic-Con in San Diego still get, that phenomena like cosplay and other sort of byproducts of modern fan culture still get. The BSI, in contrast, was always treated very well by the mainstream media, I think in part because it took on the cast of a respectable, initially gentleman's club, eventually a sort of upper middle brow society of intellectuals and bon vivants, and that character has remained in place to this day, and I do think has really influenced the way the overall Sherlockian movement, if you want to call it that, is perceived by the outside culture.
So, given that Morley and his ilk were actually part of the media machine back then, they had a voice. They had mm-hmm. the ability to reach hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people with their work. How do you think that compares to where, you know, the likes of the, I don't want to say all of the fan fiction, but some representatives of fan fiction and of fandom today. You know, I know you focused on our colleagues, the Baker Street Babes, mm-hmm. Quite a bit in the book. How does their influence impact where the fandom is going in the future, or how it's perceived by the rest of the world? Is it fair to compare what they're doing and what we're doing now versus what Morley and his colleagues did in the 30s and 40s?
I don't think you can make a direct comparison, just because the world is so different now and the way that culture is expressed has changed so radically. I do think that there are, what would you say, pieces of common ground. I mean, the Baker Street Babes are a great example because they're this sort of hybrid creature that straddles the world of what you might call traditional Sherlockiana and this sort of wild frontier of internet fan culture, motivated by many of the same enthusiasms and I guess you would say urges that Morley and his crowd were, enthusiasm for the character, a desire to socialize and sort of bond around that enthusiasm, and a desire to talk about it in public through the media that are at hand are all common to this. I mean, the media and the way that one uses them has changed so completely. It's hard to make those comparisons. And as far as the evolution of the fan culture, the fandom, if you want to call it that right now, it's really anybody's guess. I mean, it's such a sort of chaotic and rapidly evolving world, the way that fan culture behaves and evolves online is really, really hard to grasp or define. And I think what we're headed for is this kind of, very, very difficult to wrap your arms around world in which things like the BSI and the Baker Street Babes that have roots of some kind or another in traditional Sherlock Holmes culture, and things that bear almost no resemblance to traditional Sherlock Holmes culture, have to coexist and on some level interact, just because that is the nature of our world now.
Yeah.
You have to live in the world of Tunaloc, whether you like it or not. but that doesn't mean that you have to just sort of willy-nilly embrace anything. And I think that there will be many different ways that people can express their love for and interest in Sherlock Holmes, in ways that Christopher Morley would recognize, and then many that he would not.
Yeah.
To me, it just seems to be sort of an aspect of the human condition. I mean, on the one hand, I certainly understand the interest in popular culture. But, when you go back and, for example, look at Shakespeare, you know, there was a time for a long while where Shakespeare was, although the early examples of widely circulated print publication, you could say that pretty much everybody at one point had a Bible and a copy of Shakespeare's plays at home. But there was a big time in the 19th century when all of a sudden statues of Shakespeare characters pop up. People remember Shakespeare. You know, you start to get the Royal Shakespeare Company and the theater in Stratford, and industry develops. And, you know, today you've got all these fans and clubs. And there are other examples. You know, the thing about Sherlock Holmes is, you know, as you point out, the fact that it's gone on for decades. But it just seems to be part of the human condition. You know, you find a character that, or a collection of characters or a world or a literature that has a deep resonance and interest. And the different thing about Conan Doyle, of course, is the plots. You know, the fact that the characters repeat in different circumstances against different villains with different success. And and then the unusual thing about Conan Doyle was that multi-layer creation of reality. It's not it's not by an author. It's the memoir of a doctor. And the characters, you know, I think Michael Chabon has observed this. The characters are aware of their popularity. So they comment on the fact that the stories are in the Strand. And so on and so forth. So it's those clever things that, that Conan Doyle did. But in a way, you know, it's just really a very human thing.
Yeah. And, you know, it, as far as the situation we have ourselves in now, where there's this kind of incomprehensible, incomprehensibly vast internet culture around this character and many others, I think you could say is just, you know, the latest evolution of that. And it will change, evolve, and fade away in time. I mean, you could look at the different ways that Shakespeare has been perceived and enjoyed over the centuries. You know, there was certainly a time when the fact that those works were written for performance by a troupe of semi-reputable actors was definitely not the thing that people were interested in emphasizing about Shakespeare. And they were treated sort of as works of literature rather than working scripts for performance. Then that slowly changed as our sort of perception of what theater is or could be changed. And, you know, people stopped doing things like trying to give the tragedies happy endings and that sort of thing, and began to interpret them more faithfully. And then now we see this incredible profusion of different interpretations of Shakespeare, where some productions are in modern dress and others are very faithful to the Elizabethan period. And there's many different ways to take your Shakespeare. We have a similar situation with Sherlock Holmes right now, where there's virtually infinite numbers of ways to engage with the character. Some of which will prove to be enduring and others of which will be flashes in the pan. But I think you're right. I mean, I think it just does speak to something that people obviously need in their lives and in our culture.
Well, you know, we've danced around this on a number of the topics we've discussed over the past 45 minutes or so. But ultimately, Zach, what do you ascribe the enduring popularity of Sherlock Holmes too?
Well, I think there's a few things. I mean, I think that somehow Conan Doyle created a character that has enough different facets and dimensions to it that he can appeal to different eras on sort of different grounds. You know, I think that there's different aspects of Sherlock Holmes that seem more important at different times than others. You know, you could certainly look at the Sherlockian boom of the 60s and 70s and see what people were fascinated by then and contrast it with what people find fascinating about Benedict Cumberbatch's interpretation or any of the others that are currently sort of au courant, and see very different things. You know, in the 60s and 70s, Holmes and Watson and their whole world were seen as this sort of opportunity, I think, to retroactively dissect the Victorian world and sort of explore sort of the subversive or satirical elements that are lurking within Conan Doyle, or look at, you know, Holmes's drug use or some other, you know, sort of dimension of the character that felt very current and urgent at the time. And now we have let's just take Cumberbatch's portrayal as an example. We have a Sherlock Holmes who's very tech savvy, who is, you know, fully immersed in, our crazy modern world of multimedia and global communications, which is true to the original character in many ways. I mean, the Conan Doyle Holmes was well-versed in the communications technology of the original information age. And that's what seems, that's one of the things that seems fascinating to us now, the degree to which Holmes feels like a modern contemporary character. But if you go back to the, you know, the sort of first generation of the Baker Street Irregulars, particularly Edgar Smith's writing in the original series of the Baker Street Journal, you see a sort of longing for a lost world in their appreciation for Holmes and Watson's milieu, a sort of nostalgia for a different era that spoke, I think, very powerfully to people who had just been through World War II and were facing the uncertainties of the atomic age. And so just there, you have three very different ways of looking at this character, all of which are completely valid.
It was also their childhoods.
Right, right. Or a, or an era that was just slightly out of reach. You know, just they were just old enough to remember it or to have been exposed to it, but not old enough to have participated in it fully. And I think that that is a real hallmark of cultural nostalgia. I mean, you could look at the popularity of something like Mad Men in recent years, very popular among people who may have glimpsed the era that it was set in, or that was the era of their parents, or that was the era of the furniture they grew up around, but they didn't really live through it. I think that there's a similar sort of dynamic at play there. But, you know, right there you have three very different ways of looking at the character, all of which are totally valid, and all of which have their origins in what Conan Doyle created. So somehow he managed in those 60 stories to build in enough different facets and dimensions to really appeal to people at different times. I think that might be the core of it. I think there's some characteristics of Holmes that are eternally appealing. His sort of artistic interpretation of science and his use of rationality as this almost like magical tool for understanding the world, is always something people are going to resonate with one degree or another. Watson, of course, is this incredibly appealing figure. And then the sort of the tapestry of the Sherlockian world, which Conan Doyle managed to make very rich with almost like a sleight of hand technique, where very, very briefly glimpsed characters are intriguing enough that you want to keep thinking about them.
So the book is The Great Detective, The Amazing Rise and Immortal Life of Sherlock Holmes by Zach Dundas. It's been published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. You can pick up a copy online, Amazon.com certainly, and at any of your local bookstores. It's well worth a read. And Zach, we appreciate you taking the time to get under the cover of the book with us and explain a little bit more about what it is that you did.
Well, thank you so much. It's been great.
Wow. Oh, that was a delightful romp.
Yeah. What a great conversation.
The Sherlockian meadow. Yes. Yeah.
The one thing I wanted to ask him that I didn't ask him, although I guess it's sort of, implicit, is what kicked him off on it to begin with, and how many years it really this was really in the process. But clearly, because of his reporting and because of his full-time career as a journalist and his interest in popular culture, you know, I guess it's sort of obvious what stimulated it. Mm. But it's fascinating, absolutely.
Well,
fascinating.
I want to know how he got the trips financed.
Oh, right. We didn't ask.
I mean, that would be great. You know, hey, I'm on a research mission. I wonder if Harcourt, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, underwrote that, or if that was just part of his author's advance.
Yeah, I'll bet not. Yeah.
Hmm. Well, either way, it's a fascinating book. And like I said, it's not like I needed to read another book about the origins and, impact of Sherlock Holmes, but it was, very nicely done, interspersed with the tales of his travel and flashbacks, and you can tell Zach has a flair for the dramatic, because he almost sets things up as a screenwriter would in certain circumstances, and you know, it really brings the reader from scene to scene.
Mm. Yeah, so, excellent.
Yeah, pick up a copy.
Yeah.
My mind rebels at stagnation. Give me problems. Give me work. Give me the most abstruse cryptogram, the most intricate analysis, and I'm in my proper atmosphere. Then I can dispense with artificial stimulants. But I abhor the dull routine of existence. I crave mental exaltation.
Welcome to the I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere quiz program called Mental Exaltation. If you've ever listened to NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me or Weekend Edition Sunday with Puzzle Master Will Shorts, you'll be familiar with our format. But just in case you haven't listened to those, each episode we'll post a qualifying question on our website, ihearofsherlock.com. And of all the correct answers submitted, an individual will be chosen at random to become a contestant on Mental Exaltation. Now, this time around, our question was, when you look at the cover of The Great Detective, what unrecorded case is brought to mind? And interestingly, we had a lot of people that had a difficult time with this qualifying question. The answer we were looking for, of course, is the Dundas separation case. Zach, you must be you must have always gone through life thinking, "Well, I have to be a Sherlockian. My
right?
name appears
He's right there in the canon."
Absolutely,
it does make a handy talking point anytime I meet a new Sherlockian.
See, there you go. Well, our winner selected at random, or at least our contestant selected at random, is Paul Hartnett from Jamesburg, New Jersey. So, Zach, as far as the format of this quiz, you will be playing on behalf of Paul.
Okay.
We're going to ask you three questions, multiple choice, and if you answer at least two out of three of those correctly, Paul will win a copy of The Great Detective, The Amazing Rise and Immortal Life of Sherlock Holmes by you.
That's right. Paul, I apologize in advance, but here we go.
All right.
Shall the examination proceed? Yes, let it proceed by all means.
Paul, since you answered that qualifying question correctly, we've got three questions about more unrecorded cases in the career of Sherlock Holmes. Here we go. People in the Sherlock Holmes stories have terrible luck with ships. Which of the following ships is not connected with an unrecorded case? A, the Dutch steamship Friesland? B, the British passenger ship Endeavour? Or C, the cutter Alicia?
B.
Well done. Well done. You didn't even pause there. That was great.
That was slow pitch softball. All right.
Ah, this isn't going to be so bad. See?
Mm-hmm.
For your second question, we found a survey online by the Hounds of the Internet ranking all of the unrecorded cases. According to this 2003 survey, what case was voted the most interesting? A, Colonel Warburton's madness. B, the politician, the lighthouse, and the trained cormorant. Or C, the disappearance of Mr. James Fillmore.
I have to go with B.
Again, you are correct.
Good. That was guesswork.
All right.
It's a shocking habit.
Destructive to the mental capacity.
That's right.
All right. So Paul is guaranteed a copy of your book, but let's just finish this out with a third question. Our research also unearthed a reference to the giant rat of Sumatra, a musical comedy. Which of the following is not a character in this 1987 spoof musical? A, Lana Looney, a Hawaiian hacha. B, Lieutenant Michael Mockturtle, a scoundrel but handsome. Or C, Professor Theodore Tiddlewink, a terrible dresser.
C?
Well, the answer is C, Professor Theodore Tiddlewink.
All right.
A terrible dresser.
Three.
So there you go.
You've done it again.
It's amazing.
Well, that's great. That's my best performance on a Sherlockian quiz ever, by far.
There you go.
I think we should award you a copy of your own book.
I'll just award myself one. There's a few lying around the house.
And you get an hour-long call with Burt Wolder and Scott Monty.
That's right.
And Sherlock Everywhere.
We'd be happy to sign your book for you.
Go for it.
Well, thanks for playing on behalf of Paul. And folks, if you're interested in playing Mental Exaltation, watch toward the end of every month as we post the qualifying question to our website and see if you can play along or have one of our guests play on your behalf. Well, you know, I wonder if Zach was part of that implant there, the Sherlock Holmes brand genome. He did pretty well.
He did very well. Yeah, it was a very good quiz.
Yeah. A lot of fun.
Yes. Bless Nick Martorelli for the quizzes.
Indeed. Well, it looks like you've done it again. You've managed to squander, what, 3 hours? how long was this one?
Yeah, 5.5. no, it's actually maybe a little shorter, but not by much.
More respectable. Well, whatever it is, we appreciate the time that you've taken.
Yes, we do.
We are drilling directly into your head, into your ears, whether you're sitting behind the wheel of your car, whether you're walking on your treadmill, maybe you're sitting at your desk, at your cubicle, and your coworkers are laughing at the expressions you're making as we're talking about all of these sorts of things. Mm. But however it is you get I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere directly into your ears, we appreciate it, and we appreciate the time that you spend on this delightful topic of Sherlock Holmes.
We do.
Indeed. Well, I guess that remains for me to say that, allegedly, I am Scott Monty.
Well, that can't be. That would mean that I'm Burt Wolder.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
And allegedly, we both together say,
The game's afoot.
You know, I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I am neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.
Have you ever heard this?
The great divine, help each one of you, and also take care of my boy and my god wife, Jean. God help our movement forward. Let your watchword be onward and forward. Is the wish of Arthur Conan Doyle.
Is that from the seance with Harry Houdini?
It's I don't think it's got anything to do with Houdini. It's supposed to be the spirit voice of Sir Arthur after he died.
Oh, and, interesting.
Let me see.
Where did you find that?
I think if you Google search spirit voice of Arthur Conan Doyle, you will find the link.
Huh. Is it from an outtake of the 1939 Hound of the Bastards?
Yeah, so here it is. I found it. Let's see. The British Library has provided rare recordings of the author both before and after his death. at the website of the British Library, you can hear a rare recording from a speech on spiritualism Conan Doyle delivered 2 months before his death. In July 1930, 1 week after Conan Doyle's death, thousands of people attended a seance at Royal Albert Hall at which a medium claimed to have communicated with him. And 4 years later, April 28, 1934, a seance held by Noah Zerdan at Aeolian Hall attracted an audience of 560 people. Conan Doyle was only one of 44 heard speaking from the other side. It was the first large gathering of its kind to be recorded. Noah Zerdan fled the czarist regime in Russia for London and established a successful business at Oxford Street as a furrier. It was only after a devastating fire in which his wife died and his business was destroyed that he began holding seances, apparently believing he'd successfully made contact with his wife.
And he wanted to know why she made off with all those furs.
That's right.
Wow. That's fascinating.
Yeah, there it is.